The Columbia Workshop, under the direction of William N. Robeson, presents
the National Headliners.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight the workshop comes to you from the ballroom of the Hotel Ambassador in Atlantic City, where 200 newspapermen, radio reporters, and newsreel cameramen from all over the United States are gathered in attendance at the annual convention of the National Headliners Club to witness the presentation of awards to their colleagues for outstanding repertorial achievements during the past year.
The Columbia Workshop presents the National Headliners.
Headliners on the front page.
And the editorial pages.
Headliners on the newsreel screens.
And the radio sets of America.
Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press.
For outstanding public service by an American newspaper, the award of the National Headliners Club goes to...
Well, Betty?
I've talked your proposition over with my clerks. They don't want to join your union.
Yeah, they don't, eh?
No.
Well, ain't they heard that every clerk in Kansas City will be organized in a month?
Well, I'm paying them more than the union scale anyway.
That's your answer, huh?
Yes.
Okay, buddy.
It's outrageous. And anyway, I couldn't persuade my men to join even if I wanted to. The Wagner Act won't let me. That's the law.
In Kansas City, where the law?
We're not having any labor troubles here. My girls are all satisfied.
Well, the union ain't, sister.
Well, we don't intend joining.
Yeah, you'll change your mind. We'll see about that.
We have a special this week on Crokinole Waves, Mrs. Elstead. Wouldn't you like one?
Well, maybe I'd better. The Bridge Club meets tomorrow, and I think that... What was that?
I ran through something in the door.
Oh, good.
You have a thing, Mal. Oh, it makes me sick. Everybody get out of there.
485 windows broken in 4 months. Innumerable places of business emptied by stink bombs. 11 large buildings bombed with dynamite.
This was the situation in Kansas City, Missouri, in April of this year. The public suspected racketeering in labor. The politicians, wetting their axes for the spring elections, blamed each other. The police checked each vandalistic outrage, found the intimidated merchants unwilling to cooperate with information.
But there was one force in Kansas City which could not be intimidated, could not be swayed from its pledge to the service of the people. The Kansas City Journal.
Waiting until the hubbub of the election had subsided, the Journal Post on April 24th began its expose of the labor racketeers in Kansas City, demanded police action, insisted upon a grand jury investigation, hammered away day after day with information exhaustively obtained by the members of its staff.
By the middle of May, the campaign of the Journal Post finally moved the police department to action. By May 20th, suspects were being arrested, were confessing.
My name is Howard Hatfield. I'm 18 years old. There was a bunch of fellas that hung around headquarters. They had a car in which they had brickbats and some ball bearings. They'd pull out away from our headquarters around 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night and they'd come back later on. I'm the man that Wally Mahon gave the money to pay these men for their activities in a window breaking. But I had no time of actually taking part in any window breaking, and I can only account for
my name is Frank Bruns. I walked the picket line at the alley in 13th Street. Once we located a Jones truck with a car of guards following it. There was a bottle of ink on the floor of the car I was in. Well, I picked it up and threw it at the guard's car, striking the side of the car. After about 4 weeks of the strike, local number 41 voted to pay...
My name's Harry Barker. I worked for the Jones Store Company when we were called out on strike on account of the clerks' union. During the strike, I'd go out in a car with several other men to try to stop the Jones Store trucks from making deliveries. When we found one of them on the streets, we'd throw rocks, bricks, or anything that came handy to us at them or the guards following them. Several times when I'd throw some missiles at a truck or a car...
But lest there be some misunderstanding, the Journal Post front pages...
The police and the prosecutor are finally cooperating effectively in a campaign against labor racketeering. The police have made arrests and the prosecutor has filed charges. In this manner, they have served a belated but certain warning to terrorists that law and order in Kansas City are not yet bankrupt. The Journal Post is gratified if its campaign against racketeering has resulted not only in a better quality of law enforcement, but in aiding legitimate organized labor to preserve public goodwill.
The Journal Post might well be gratified, for due to its courageous campaign, the name of legitimate organized labor in Kansas City was cleared, and a succession of small fry, cheap labor racketeers, were ushered into the police station and thence to punishment in the most predatory racket terror of 1938.
For this splendid campaign, the National Headliners Club tonight awards its silver plaque for the outstanding public service of an American newspaper to the Kansas City Journal-Post, whose campaign against labor racketeers was conducted by its editors, W. Lawrence Dickey and Johnny Johnson.
For outstanding work by an American columnist, the National Headliners Club awards a silver plaque to Raymond Clapper of the United Features Service.
For the best foreign news reporting, the National Headliners Club awards...
Press rate, United Press, New York, by John R. Morris, United Press staff correspondent. Shanghai, August 14th, 1937. Chinese bombing airplanes apparently trying to destroy the old Japanese cruiser Izumo off the waterfront of the busiest part of the international settlement changed the tea lounge of the Palace Hotel from a comfortable box seat to a stage for fast-moving drama.
Hey, that was an interesting show this morning, Morris.
The bombardment?
Yeah. The Japanese fleet is in the river only a day. They start dropping three shells at a time, waiting 3 minutes, and then dropping three more.
Checking their range, that's my guess, Eakins.
Yes, but with the precision of a flower arrangement or a silk painting. How long do you think this attack will last, John?
How do I know, Bud? From the look of the fleet out there in the river, it seems the Japanese have come to stay.
Well, of course, we're perfectly safe here in the international settlement.
Apparently, most of the natives from Shepai think so, too. Look at Nanking Road out there, packed with refugees from the front windows of the palace here to the revolving door of the cafe across the street.
Poor devils. No homes, no food, scared to death. What's it all about?
Westward, the path of empire, Bud. Listen, what's that?
Sounds like anti-aircraft guns.
Yeah, it is. Look out the window. The Izumo's firing at something.
And planes, you see them up there?
Yeah, Chinese planes. One of them's dropped a bomb. Look at it.
It's coming this way, John.
Yeah, it is. Better get back from the windows, folks. That bomb's dropping this way. Get back from the window. If it hits near here, you'll be cut by glass.
You all right, Bud?
Yeah, I think so.
Must hit the top of the building.
Yeah.
Get across the street to the office and flash it. I'll check up on the dead here.
Okay, John. Take care of yourself.
Yeah.
I ran out to the Nanking Road side of the narrow lounge, hurtling overturned tea tables, chairs, and the prostrate forms of guests seeking the safety of the floor. Through the gaping windows of the Nanking Road, I could see at least 50 persons writhing on the sidewalks and roadways. Three foreigners were trying to crawl away over the bodies of the dead Chinese.
Look out, look out! Here comes
another
one!
Another crash sent up a geyser of dust and debris, which temporarily obscured my view. This one brought merciful death to some already dying, but added scores of new names to the list of killed or maimed. It was a half hour before effective first aid arrived, an agonizing 30 minutes. The lobby was densely packed with dying and wounded. The tile floor was slippery from their blood. From the hospitals where they had taken the wounded, the volunteers' trucks returned to be filled with the torn and broken fragments.
Within 2 minutes after the first bomb struck, the world knew of the Nanking Road bombings. Within 30 minutes of the Holocaust, John Morris' graphic eyewitness story was being received in hundreds of wire rooms of the member newspapers of the United Press all over America. For this worldwide beat on the first horror of the Sino-Japanese War, tonight the National Headliners Club awards John Morris of the United Press its silver headliner's plaque.
A little baby, its head bleeding, its clothes in tatters, sits crying amid the shambles of the bombed Shanghai railroad station. This picture brought home to uncounted millions the sheer, speechless horror of war, tells indeed much more than 1,000 words. The National Headliners Club considers it the best news picture of the year, awards its silver plaque to H.S. Wang, Far Eastern representative of the Hearst News of the day.
In mid-December of last year, aboard the USS Panay, anchored somewhere on the broad, muddy Yangtze north of Nanking, another headliner awaited his rendezvous with fame. when Japanese bombers suddenly attacked the ship. Norman Alley, ace Universal newsreel cameraman who had come aboard with a party of American refugees from the besieged and burning Chinese capital, exchanged film for bombs.
While the Japanese planes attacked and reattacked the ship, while half-clad blue jackets pierced the noonday sky with stabbing, searching machine gun bullets, while badly wounded American sailors and civilians were taken from the sinking Panay, Norman Alley, wounded himself, photographed the first American naval engagement since the World War, recorded the stricken survivors huddled on the marshy bank of the Yangtze, recorded the agonizing trek through hostile backcountry to civilization, the evacuation by the friendly British gunboat Ladybird.
And then, utilizing the ultimate in modern transportation, Norman Alley brought his story home. By U.S. naval escort to Manila, by China clipper across the Pacific to San Francisco, by chartered main liner across America to New York, where less than 24 hours after his arrival, the great document he had photographed at life's risk was being shown to audiences all over the country.
For this unprecedented newsreel scoop, Norman Alley tonight receives the Year's Award for the finest example of motion picture reporting.
On another war front this year, another great headliner wrote his last story. On the last day of 1937, Eddie Neal, ace Associated Press correspondent, veteran of the conquest of Ethiopia and the Palestine race riots, was once more under fire in the little Spanish village of Codite. Eddie Neal was wounded in a score of places. They took him to a hospital in Sargasso. Next day, he said with a grin,
"Well, I guess the war's over for me."
He was right. On January 2nd, it was 30. The newspaper code for the end of the story for Eddie Neal.
Tonight, the National Headliners Club is proud to honor a valiant colleague who died on the job. Posthumously awards him the silver plaque for his excellent stories from the Spanish front lines.
For the best non-fiction magazine article of general interest, the National Headliners awards its silver plaque to Joseph Alsop of the North American Newspaper Alliance and Turner Catledge of the New York Times for their historical series of stories on the Supreme Court fight, which appeared last September in the Saturday Evening Post under the title The 168 Days.
For the best piece of domestic newsreel reporting, the award of the headliners goes
Say,
to...
what the devil are jumping balloons?
Never mind what they are, Al. You get up that old Orchard Main with your little hand camera, and the boys will explain everything to you.
Jumping balloons, ladies and gentlemen, were devised in Germany by an inquisitive cameraman. By tying enough hydrogen-filled meteorological balloons to a harness, it is possible for the man wearing the harness to jump over fences, ponds, and even houses. Well, such strenuous and gravity-defying activity offers a new field of camera angles to an enterprising balloon-hitched newsreel cameraman. And Al Mingalone of the Paramount News is not only enterprising, but famous for his angle shots.
After several unsuccessful jumps on the golf course at Old Orchard, Maine the next day, Al Mingalone got to the root of the trouble.
You guys just aren't giving me enough lift.
What are you talking about, Al? You got 30 balloons tied on your harness right now.
Well, I can't get a jump out of it. I'm pancaking like an old Jenny. Tie on two more balloons.
You'll go to the moon, Al.
Oh, no, I won't. That's what you got this anchor line for.
All right, here she goes.
Say, Al, I want you to meet a friend of mine, Father Mullen.
How do you do, Father?
Hello, Al.
Say, what's that rifle for?
Oh, the father's a crack shot, Al.
Yes, I'm out to shoot some golf this morning.
Okay, Al, you got two more on now.
All right, now wait till I lay down my back so I can shoot up at the balloons. Okay. Let her go.
Up goes Al Mingaloon, dangling like a doll on a bunch of toy balloons, spinning round and round, shooting pictures of every angle he can conceive. Al goes up, but he doesn't come down. 20, 40, 60 feet he rises until he reaches the end of the anchor line, and then... Terror-frozen, Al Mingalone looks down at the rapidly receding earth, sees one after another of the crowd run after the skipping end of his anchor line and fail to catch it.
sees his friends pile into automobiles and start across country after him 1,000 feet below.
Al has one weapon against such an emergency, a pair of scissors. If he can reach the ring on which the 32 balloons are tied and cut some of them loose, he'll come down. But the ring has slipped, is 6 feet over his head. He struggles to lift himself up the twisted rope and drops his camera. Instinctively, futilely, he reaches for it, but it falls away too quickly, leaving the cameraless cameraman quite up in the air.
Down below, he can see the traffic jams he is causing on the country roads, can hear the excited sirens of the police. He sails through a cloud or two as the rain begins drumming on the fiendish balloons above him, then into the clouds for a long time. He can hear the sound of the motor of the Coast Guard plane sent up after him. Fortunately, they do not meet in the clouds.
Al Mingalone emerges from the clouds over Biddeford, Maine, 13 miles from his starting point at Old Orchard. He's riding at 2,400 feet now, and his cup of bitterness overflows as somebody starts shooting at him. This last indignity is almost too much when he suddenly realizes the purpose of the target practice. The marksman is puncturing his balloons one by one, and Al is slowly settling back to earth.
Hey, hey, cut it out! Don't shoot anymore! You might not hit a balloon.
Hey, get your hits in a minute.
Won't be any too soon.
Touch that tree, Hank.
Yeah, my kids will want a couple of those balloons.
How do you feel?
Okay, I guess. Say, who the devil was shooting at me?
Father Mullen. He's one of the best shots in the state of Maine.
Yeah, Al. You better go to church next Sunday.
A moment later, the balloons tore free from their moorings and sailed away. A week later, they were found in upper New York State. Weathermen figured they had traveled on air currents as far west as the Mississippi River. Al Mingalone has never regretted missing that trip. They recovered his camera, muddy, but with film intact in a field 10 miles away. For this amazing and fortunately happy adventure, the National Headliners Club tonight awards its silver plaque to Al Mingalone of Paramount News. For the outstanding series of newspaper cartoons, the Headliners Club award goes to...
Inviting the Undertaker.
A campaign of simple illustrated messages by C.D. Batchelor of the New York Daily News.
If you're in a hurry, cut across the streets between lights. You may save a second 1,000 times and lose 40 years only once.
On a stormy night, start across the street with an umbrella between you and an approaching car.
Show off to your sweetie pie by passing everything on the road.
Wear your ties down to the fabric. If they don't blow out or skid you into a wreck, you'll save money.
Don't worry if you were so plastered you can't remember where you left the car the night before. If you'd killed someone, you'd be in jail. If you'd hit another car, you might be dead. You know you aren't, quite.
For these and scores of other pithy, sardonic gems of safety advice, illustrated with simple graphic drawings, the National Headliners Club awards its silver plaque to C.D. Batchelor of the New York Daily News.
For writing the best and most colorful feature story of the year on the end of Detroit's Purple Gang, W.B. Ragsdale of the Washington Bureau of the Associated Press tonight receives the award of the National Headliners Club.
For the best domestic news reporting, the Headliners Award goes to the Chicago Daily Times for its comprehensive series of articles revealing...
It can't happen here. It is happening at the German-American Bund Camp at Yaphank, Long Island.
It's happening at Hindenburg Park in Los Angeles. It's happening at the Deutsche Centrale Farm in Cleveland, at Camp Effdender in Detroit, at Camp Deutschhorst at Croydon, Pennsylvania.
To determine just how far Nazi organization has gone in the United States, Louis Ruppel, managing editor of the Chicago Daily Times, last year assigned John and James Metcalf, two of his best reporters, to change their identities, their nationalities, and their ideas, and join the German-American Bund. A third man, William Mueller, made his investigation from the outside.
For months, the two Metcalf brothers lived their strange new identities, massing information, documenting facts, investigating the extent of Nazi activities in the United States.
On the outside, their colleague William Mueller assisted their investigations, organizing their material, preparing the campaign of the expose. Finally, early in September, managing editor Rupel was ready. On Thursday, September 9th, the Chicago Times headline screamed across the front page,
"Secrets of the Nazi Army in the USA!"
Fully documented, illustrated with photographs showing the two Metcalf brothers in stormtroopers' uniforms participating in Nazi demonstrations, the Times story was sensational. Caused reverberations as far away as Berlin. Fritz Kuhn, national leader of the America Deutsche Volksbund, says,
No, this is not true. It is all for the United States what we do. We are going to step in and protect the United States. Our organization is just waiting until the communists get ready to seize control, which will be sooner than you think. So long as there is a swastika, there will be no hammer and sickle in this country.
Representative Samuel Dickstein of New York claims the German-American Bund has 350,000 members. The Daily Times, with understatement, which characterized its entire campaign, states that there are only 20,000. Says J. Edgar Hoover, G-Man chief,
"We expect to make an extended report on the Nazi matter."
Says a spokesman for the German Foreign Office,
"We expect every German citizen of the United States to be a good German, but at the same time, scrupulously to respect the laws of the country."
For so turning the searchlight of publicity upon Nazi activities in the United States, the National Headliners Club tonight salutes reporters James and John Metcalf and William Mueller and their chief, Louis Rupel. And to them and the Chicago Daily Times awards the silver plaque for the best piece of domestic reporting.
On Friday night, I was not even thinking of Austria. Then suddenly, I knew that the deed and the hour were predetermined. I did not consult anyone. I gave order.
Friday, March 11th. Faithful Friday.
At 7:56 that morning, listeners to the Columbia Network heard the first news bulletin of the day.
The Austrian detail was likely to boil over at any minute. Chancellor Schuschnigg said that if necessary, he will proclaim martial law on Sunday when Austria's 7.5 million citizens vote in the national independence referendum.
Later that same Friday morning, the head of the CBS Public Affairs Department receives a transatlantic telephone call.
Ed Murrow on the wire.
Yeah, where's he calling from?
Warsaw.
Put him on. Hello?
Hello, Ed. Paul.
Yeah, what's up?
Plenty. I just talked with Bill Schreier in Vienna.
Yeah?
He tells me they've closed Ravik, the Vienna radio station. Says it looks like Hitler's planning to move in.
What do you think?
Oh, I don't think that he'll never let that election be held on Sunday.
Yeah, hold the line a minute. Miss Jacobs.
Yes?
Get Shira in Vienna right away.
Yes.
When you get him, patch him into this line. Ed.
Right.
Hang on, I'm calling Shira.
All right.
...border of the town of Tosdow. The swastika flag is now flying from the top of the Chancery building, which is the seat of the Austrian government.
Mr. Shira in Vienna is ready, sir.
Thanks. Hello, Bill.
Yes, Paul.
I got in on here, too. Can you hear me, Ed?
Sure.
How's it look, Bill?
The government's fallen. The Nazis are moving in.
All right, then. Now, here's what you do. Ed, you get a plane and fly into Vienna right away.
Okay.
Bill, you get a plane and fly to London. We'll put you on the air from there with an eyewitness report where they can't censor you.
Right.
And, Ed, you make all arrangements for going on the air from Vienna if the stations reopen and they're not censoring everything by the time you get there.
Okay.
This way, we'll duck censorship in one place anyway.
Right.
Okay, boys. Now get going and best of luck.
So long.
Here's somewhere close to the Austrian border.
German troops are marching all over the frontiers of Austria. Chancellor Hitler himself took off for Berlin in a plane. Just before he left, Hitler...
As long columns of efficient motorized Nazi troops follow their beloved Führer across the Austrian border, as William Shire flies to uncensored London, and Edward Murrow plays 5,000 marks to charter a plane from Berlin to Vienna, lights burn all night on the 17th floor of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in New York City. Columbia's complicated radio schedules are broken down, torn apart, to prepare for the broadcast to come from Europe, to prepare the CBS audience for history in the making. The first of these transatlantic pickups occurred on Saturday night, March 12th, at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, shortly after Shira arrived in London.
Hello, America. I'm here in London tonight to report what I saw, not to give my personal opinion. I saw no disorder in Vienna provoked by the workers. But when I arrived in Berlin this noon, I found that the newspapers were appearing in flaming headlines about violent red disorders, as they put it, in Vienna. And I have here before me the front pages of Chancellor Hitler's own newspapers, the focus of attention this morning. Its banner headline reads, German Austria saved from chaos. Austria's resistance to Nazi...
Hourly bulletins, a second London pickup. Within another 4 hours, while the whole wide world, Columbia facilities set up one of the most complicated broadcasts in the history of radio. On Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, CBS brought America the dramatic tour of the five world capitals. From London, England, William Shire introduced Miss Ellen Wilkinson, Labour Member of Parliament.
No one in Britain wants war. It is not that the British are afraid of Hitler and Mussolini. If they have to fight, they will. But there is no war feeling here as yet. The feeling here, though the people are deeply moved,
without a hitch, the next speaker joins the broadcast from Paris, Mr. Edgar Maurer, European correspondent of the Chicago Daily News.
The densely populated purlieus of Paris, in all those gray and provincial towns and hamlets and quiet villages that are really fun, something seems to be stirring, something that has been quiet since 1919. If I were Adolf Hitler, I should...
Back to New York goes the control, as Bob Trout introduces Pierre J. Huss of International News Service, speaking from Berlin.
I have found a keen desire amongst all classes, official and private, to impress upon the outsider the fact that Austria has come back to the German fold of its own will. This is exclusively a German affair.
Waiting in Vienna is Edward Murrow, who encountered the anticipated censorship, but who refused to make ordered cuts in his copy, and who then, after strenuous argument, was reluctantly permitted to broadcast.
I arrived here by air from Warsaw and Berlin only a few hours ago. I'd like to tell you a few things I've seen and heard in the course of the day. From the air, Vienna didn't look much different, but nevertheless, it's changed. The crowds are courteous as they've always been, but many people are in a holiday mood. They lift the right arm a little higher here than in Berlin, and Heil Hitler is said a little more loudly. Nearly every principal building has its armed guard, including the one from which I'm speaking. We're planning to bring you an eyewitness account of Herr Hitler's entry into Vienna sometime tomorrow. And we return you now to America.
And now in our studios in Washington, D.C., we are to hear from the Honorable Louis B. Schwellenbach, Democratic Senator from the state of Washington. We take you now to Washington, D.C.
Never in the world's history has it been more necessary for democracy to work than it is for democracy to work here now. The permanent advance of civilization depends...
Thus, during the Austrian crisis, Ed Murrow and Bill Shire kept America informed hour after hour of each new development across Europe, from 10 Downing Street to the capital of Lithuania. Through more than 50 special Columbia broadcasts, in a handful of critical days, American listeners were kept abreast of racing history. For this superb radio coverage, the National Headliners Club tonight awards its silver plaque to William B. Shire and Ed Murrow of the Columbia Network.
The noblest commission of the Italian citizen is to subordinate himself to the state.
You must not think dangerous thoughts. Thoughts are not dictated by those of your emperor.
A powerful national government may take the responsibility for large incursions on the liberty of individuals. In its capacity as a state, the German Reich must gather all Germans to itself with spit on freedom.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of their grievances.
Only in a democracy, perhaps only in the United States of America, could these newspapermen, cameramen, and radio reporters have reported so freely on controversial issues as to receive these awards from a jury of their peers. Only in a democracy, perhaps only in the United States of America, could this broadcast have been made today.
You have just heard the Columbia Workshop's dramatization of the awards presented by the National Headliners Club for the outstanding newspaper newsreel and radio news coverage during the past year. This special workshop broadcast has come to you from the ballroom of the Hotel Ambassador in Atlantic City and was written and directed by William N. Robeson. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.